Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm and author of Investing Simplified, the book. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual professional advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated. Investing Simplified is the longest-running live financial show in America, with a financial advisor, an estate planning attorney, and a CPA to answer your questions for free, and is broadcast live from Portland, Oregon on affiliated stations throughout the Pacific Northwest. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck with a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com. Or you can call him right now at 503-417-9595. That's 503-417-9595. Or for our long distance and podcast listeners, you can call toll free at 877-733-1011. That's 877-733-1011. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
Well, good morning, Portland and the Pacific Northwest. Hope you're staying dry and inside and staying warm, because it's a little chilly out there this morning. But typical December day in the Great Northwest. Listen, in studio with me today, we've got the whole gang. We've got Carl Jeffson here. Carl, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen.
And Kevin Stege with the Baker Colson CPA firm. And Carl is with the Carl Jeffson Attorney at Law.
Good morning to three amigos.
Yeah, hey, we're back. I have to say, last week, guys, at this time, I was in Disneyland. Well, now, Kevin says I was in Fantasyland, but that's probably true.
Hey, well, wait until you get all the business the contracts that we signed for you.
Yeah. Oh, boy, I can hardly wait. Yeah, that'll be exciting. Hey, listen, this show is all about you, the listener. Pick up the phone. Give us a call. You know, we're on here. We come here in the morning, and we come here to talk to you. So pick up the phone and give us a call, 503-417-9595. Toll free 877-733-1011. And in typical fashion, just so you know, my website where you can send us a text message for whatever reason is not working. I've got my IT guy working on it, but I don't know if it'll be up for the show. So instead of sending us a text, I would suggest you just pick up the phone and dial and call and ask a question, and we'll answer it right then, right?
Absolutely, as best we can, of course.
As best
there's
we
always
can.
The usual disclaimer. That,
yeah, except when I'm gone, you guys just answer it for me, right?
Well, yeah, we say there is no disclaimer today. This is the absolute truth.
Okay.
This is
right. Okay. Well, listen, I'm extremely excited. Can you hand me that picture over there that I gave to you?
That one?
Not that one.
Not that one?
The one with the book.
Oh, your book, yes.
Yeah. And so that's okay. Well, I'll find it.
The one I handed across to you was the new tax rates. That got me excited.
Well, speaking about that, you know, everybody, we've had lots of emails. I've had lots of calls about the new tax law, and it looks like it's finally going to get done. But I still kind of reserve really getting into it until we actually see the final thing signed, because you know what? Unfortunately, the people we have running our government, they make deal after deal after deal, and you never know until the final thing comes in, and it could change. But as of right now, I have heard so much misinformation on the news. I've had people come into my office and just say to me, "Oh my God, the world's falling apart. The new tax law is just, I'm going to pay so much more in taxes." And then I find out how much income they make, and I say, you know, it looks like to me you're going to get about $1,800 lower of a bill than you got last year. And they look at me like, well, that's not what I heard on the news today. Listen, folks, if you don't know by now, the news is full of crap. They say what they want to say. Unfortunately, nobody calls them on the facts. We do on our show. But, you know, nobody calls them on it. The fact is, as I understand the tax break, Kevin, and I just looked at the chart here. Mm-hmm. This is pretty much the one that they're going to do, either the House version or the Senate version. But in either one of them, any married couple who's making under $75,000 is getting a tax break. There's no other way you can say it. I mean, I don't know how these guys. I watched a guy on TV today, and I thought, oh my God. And then I'm looking at the chart and I'm saying, what the heck is he reading? Because he was blatantly lying right on. Of course, he's a congressman. What do you expect? I think he's from California, too. California. Yeah. Anyway, he was saying that, that you know, everybody was going to pay higher tax. It was just a break for the rich. Well, I don't think if you make $75,000 of income, you're rich.
Nope.
I mean, I don't think so. And not in the category that I usually get to see. But I'm just going to tell you, most people on the new tax bill are getting a tax break. And I'm going to have somebody on after the first of the year who is an expert on insurance. And we're going to talk about the truth about how many people. About the mandate going away. And Kevin, we're all going to save some tax money, are we not?
Most likely.
Yep.
Never say never, but.
Never say never.
Yeah. And I'll give my two cents later on in the show. But in general, it seems like I just this morning was able to start reading some of the final details as they have released them because they finally came up to an agreement yesterday. And so I was pretty skeptical, I guess, that this was going to benefit Main Street, which I think is the crux of our country. And I was happy to see a lot of the provisions that were finally agreed upon.
Well, one of the things, the whole purpose of the tax break, as I understood it from the people who put it together, was to give Main Street a break, to finally give the American citizen a break. And I'm sorry, Congressman, not you guys, but for us average people, you know, a tax break. And so, hey, you know, we got one of our favorite callers on the line here. And I know this guy has called in numerous times. Henry, are you there?
I'm here.
How are you doing?
Well, not bad for an old man, I guess.
Well, it's all relative.
My question is, my doctor always tells me it's just a number, so forget it.
That's right.
In any event, my question is, if I've listened to the reports correctly, and you guys set me straight if I'm wrong, the corporate tax rate is going down to 21 from where it is now. And it is permanent, but the tax rates for people, citizens, will have new rates, but they expire in 2025. What does that mean, and what happens then?
Well, if you remember back to the Bush tax bill, and when it expired, it died, and it went back. And that's what's going to happen in 10 years if they don't change it and make it permanent.
Okay.
So you pretty much said it right, do you think?
That's right. Remember 2010 when they were going to do away with well, they did. I mean, they were going to have this a lot of things, and including the estate tax, and then it did for a year. And it sent people scrambling, though, because nobody, you know, people had planned for the other way, and it was a messy thing.
So here's how it's going to play out is the reason they made the business permanent is businesses need to know they can't just have a 6-year set of rules and then have it change completely in another 6 years. They have to have a knowledge of what's coming up. And they also needed this bill to reconcile all the budget features and all that stuff that you hear about. So they had to have some of this tax breaks or cuts sunset because the Senate doesn't have 60 votes to say whatever they want. The House it has the votes to do what they want, but the Senate is locked into some budget stuff. So this is the part that they said is going to sunset is the individual. Because the president in 2025, if he doesn't re-ante these up like they did with the Bush stuff, it'll basically be a de facto tax hike on all of America. And so if it's a Democrat president, he'll be looked at as he or she will be looked at as raising the rates and cranking up tax hike in 2025. And if it's a Republican, then they'll most likely extend it. So I think that's how it's going
to
play out.
Well, but they'll try to extend it. They'll have to have the House and the Senate agreeable.
Exactly.
That's one of the crazy things about America, and I think it's a good thing, is that we have the three bodies of government, and then the fourth one, the judicial, that comes in and steps on them once in a while and should. But you get the House and the Senate and the president, and those three bodies work together, sometimes not too well, but... I personally like the new tax bill. So I got to say, Kevin, you know, when you're doing taxes for people, how many people have and explain this to me, is the exemption up to $10,000, is that $10,000 out of pocket, or is that $10,000 of taxes you pay?
Well, it's going to be taxes you pay out of pocket. It's going to be a combination of your property taxes and your state income tax or local income tax. We don't have a too high of a local, but Washington.
Or sales tax.
Yeah, say again?
Or sales tax is in there too.
Exactly. Sales tax for Washington. There's a that calculation usually ends up not being too significant, but it's in there for sure. Yeah.
Okay, so if somebody has property tax of $12,000, just make it simple.
$10,000.
They're going to be able to write the 10 off against their federal.
Yep.
But the other two, they're not.
Correct. And no other state or local income taxes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Or sales tax.
And you know what that says to me is that puts it back on the state to be accountable for the taxes they're charging their customers, which is the citizens. And I don't think that's a bad thing at all. I think it's kind of nice to maybe put the onus back on the state and say, geez, how are you guys spending our tax money? Maybe you ought to be a little more accountable to how you're spending it. Don't you think?
Yep.
What do you think? What do you think there, Henry?
Of course, accountability is great.
Yeah, absolutely.
If it isn't a backroom deal that benefits a certain segment,
well,
it's got to represent the people and be something that everybody gets a little piece of, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, we really appreciate you calling. I wish you happy holidays and Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And keep giving us calls back. We really appreciate it. I've got to get another call, though, right now. We've got another caller on the line. So thank you very much, Henry. We've got Julie on the line. Julie, are you there?
Yes.
You got a great question about Roth conversions.
Yes. I have an IRA, and I wanted to move part of it into a Roth, back into my Roth, so that I would be paying the taxes now, because it would be a tax advantage for me at this point in my life. And
you mean you're going to be in a lower bracket this year than next year?
Well, actually, it's going to be for several years, yes.
Oh, okay. Okay, then yeah, you're absolutely right. The only thing I would caution you on, and this is one of the things, Kevin and I haven't had a chance to talk, so I'm going to just talk off the top of my head on this thing. But there is a change in the new tax law proposed on recharacterizing your Roth conversion. So if you're going to do it correctly, and then understand that you're probably not going to be able to recharacterize it into the next year. Right, Kevin?
Something like that.
Yeah, pretty close.
Yep.
So and the thing is, we're just cautioning people who are doing it, be sure you do exactly what you want to do, because what the recharacterization, if you got to go back and redo it and recharacterize it and pull it back out, could be ramifications.
So would the takeaway from that be that if you're going to do it before the end of this year?
Do it before the end of this year, and well, depending on your tax bracket. I mean, I think, Julie, you're on top of it because your taxes are going up for the next few years. So this is a great year for you to do the conversion.
Well, I'm only doing it partially. I mean, I have an IRA, and I'm moving it into my Roth IRA, and I'm only doing part of it, and the credit union says they charge me $25 each time I do it.
I think that's probably standard about in banks and credit unions.
But my concern is this something that I don't understand what you're saying about recharacterization. I was going to do my own taxes, and I thought it would be just something pretty simple.
Well, I think for the most part, it would be pretty simple, and it sounds like you've kind of looked it through and have a good plan. The only hesitation I would have is check out the new tax law, and I haven't had a chance to read the details on how this is going to work, but I did see that there was going to be some limitations on that type of transaction in terms of undoing it.
You want to explain to her, Julie, what a recharacterization is?
Sure thing. Are you good on that, Julie? Do you need to, the recharacterization is basically where you would go back from your Roth to your IRA, but it doesn't sound like you're needing to do that.
I wouldn't want to do that for any reason that I could imagine.
Okay. So then, you should be in pretty good order to do it. I would probably check out that new bill and just see what the provisions are. And in general, like you say, you'll recognize a little income for the amount that you convert this year and future years.
Yeah, it's a very smart move, I think, particularly if you're going to have higher income over the next few years, to take advantage of it and do it right now. Absolutely. You're very smart on that.
Well, that's what I was aiming to do.
Yep. Good. That's a good financial move.
Okay, that's good.
Okay, and okay, do you have any other questions?
Well, I just didn't understand. I don't understand why anybody would want to recharacterize it, because my understanding was that once you move it out of the regular IRA into a Roth IRA, then you could let it sit there the rest of your life and never have to withdraw anything and never have to pay any taxes. Isn't that a good thing to have it sitting there where you don't have to deal with it?
Absolutely, but what if the market, what if you have it in stocks and the market takes a big, big correction?
And basically, say your value of your IRA right now is $100,000 and you convert 50 of that over to your Roth, you're paying tax on $50,000, but then within a certain time period, you see the market took a correction and instead of being worth $100,000, it's only worth $60,000, which would be brutal, but that happens.
It could happen.
And you just paid tax on, $50,000, and instead of, you could have paid tax on only $30,000. So what you can do is you can recharacterize it back to your IRA and then redo the conversion at a lower rate and pay.
In his example, you do it on 30 instead of 50.
Exactly.
So you'd only pay tax on 30 instead of 50, and saving the tax on $20,000 would be pretty nice.
But I think those rules are going to get tightened down.
They're going to get changed.
Yeah.
My notes say the same thing, Kevin. There's an adjustment going to be made on that, and I think they're trying to disallow them in the future. So do it now, and 9 times out of 10, you've got your money in the credit union. Is it in a bank CD or?
It was a CD, and then they changed it to a savings account, so that the IRA could be accessed at any time.
Okay, perfect. Then you don't have a problem to worry about in the recharacterization then in your case, because you're going to have no fluctuation of the market. So you don't have anything to worry about.
Yeah. Okay. Unfortunately, I don't make any money on it, so.
Well, yeah, but you know what? Sometimes it's better to be safe than sorry.
Yeah, that's what I figured. But yep, the market has done so good lately that I maybe was, maybe I made a mistake.
Well, I think
it out of that.
I'm going to talk about the market a little bit later in the show, but I think the market's going to do really, really well in 18. I'm not so sure about 19, but I think 18 is going to be a double-digit return year. So,
Listen,
thank you very much for the call. We've got another caller on the line. It's Catherine, I believe. Oh, listen, before I get to Catherine, I've got to take a quick break, and then we'll come right back.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hi,
I'm Carl Jepsen, estate planning attorney and co-host of the radio program Investing Simplified. I recently left the Warren Allen Law Firm to open my own office. Professional and personable service have always been the hallmarks of my practice. I believe that this move will allow me to spend more time with my clients. For more than 37 years, it has been my privilege to assist clients with practical estate planning with wills, trusts, powers of attorney, advance directives, and other documents so that they may have peace of mind knowing that their affairs are in order. When probate becomes necessary, emotions of family members may become fragile. Having an experienced attorney that can empathize with what the client is going through makes the process much easier. My new office is conveniently located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 101, just across from Mall 205, and my phone number is 971-229-0585. That's 971-229-0585.
Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepsen, estate planning attorney, with Carl's Comments. You can call Carl now at 503-417-9595 or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's Carl Jepsen.
Back to Investing Simplified, and we are going to talk about Carl's Comments, but not now.
Yeah, we're going to have Catherine's got a question. Yeah.
Catherine on. Catherine, are you there? Hello?
Oh, that's okay. We've got Gordon. Gordon, are you there?
Yeah, hi.
Okay, he's got a question about tax law, so this is perfect.
Well, no, I've just got a statement to make. I know everybody's talking about all the money we're going to save, but then also maybe we should talk about things that we're going to lose, like our deduction for solar and electric cars. We're not gonna, that's the future of this country. We're going to lose charitable deductions. We're going to lose athletic deductions for business people like us. I mean, I hope you guys would discuss also on the other end of the board what we're going to lose.
Well, that's a very good point. And I guess my take on this whole tax bill is, and I'll just start from the top, internationally, the U.S. is at a severe disadvantage in corporate tax structure. And basically, we have, with this tax bill, we're leveling the playing field internationally. So I think that is a good thing. In so doing, they have plugged a number of corporate deductions, such as entertainment. And as you noted, included in that is the box tickets, sky seats for university season tickets, that type of a thing. People... you know, are taking deductions for something they may or may not have already give to their university. I think this tax bill also has plugged a number of special interest loopholes. Solar credit, all of those types of things, you know, that's up for political debate. Do we subsidize that in a special industry, or do we just level the playing field and let those who want to invest in those things take the risk as opposed to having the federal government subsidize those? So I think that's it's good you bring that point up, and those are some things to talk about. I like the bill because it seems to me to level, even on the individual basis, it seems to level the federal taxation and get rid of, across the country, no matter if you're a blue or a red state, you're now paying the same tax. Us blue states, we got away with paying less federal tax all these years because of our big state deductions. But now we have, I think a lot of these things are getting plugged, and there may be some argument as to if it's fair or not. But, one could argue a lot of folks think that the education benefits, the credits, the write-off of the student loan interest, and the tax-free wages, Social Security and Medicare tax-free wages that graduate students get to make while working for the university, they're going to still get those benefits. You could argue, why should somebody be able to, who's a graduate student who's going to be making a very good salary once they graduate, they're free of Social Security and Medicare. So there's a lot of things to talk about, and I'm curious to hear
let me just interject one. How about the Good Hope deduction?
That should it's not that. It's called the American Opportunity Credit, and that's...
Is that the one that George Bush started?
The Hope Credit was Clinton, and the American Opportunity, I believe, came through the Bush tax cuts.
See, one time I had three kids going to college, mm-hmm. and I got a deduction because of that, because colleges to me are, you know, the price is outrageous, but that's another subject. But the point is that deduction still going to be there for parents who are funding their kids' education?
I believe it remains untouched, yes.
Oh, it does. Okay. Yes. All right. Well, yeah. That was just my comment, is that I think we need to look at both sides of these arguments, too, sometimes neutrally. Because there are things, I mean, I think that, you know, solar and everything is the future of this country, and we need to promote it because, you know, otherwise, whatever. Anyway. Okay, well, I appreciate
that. Yeah, and that's a great point, because that's one of the things why we said at the very start of the show, it's not final yet. So we're just talking about some of the highlights, and everything could change. Who knows? We don't really know.
Well, go ahead.
That's part of the problem. I think it's part of the problem is they're not highlighting it to people like me or somebody, so we understand exactly what's going on. I mean, it's 500 pages of law of, you know, things that we're not going to ever understand until after we get the bill and stuff.
Exactly. And I think yesterday they finally locked it down. And now we'll start seeing pieces of it. And once they sign it, we'll finally get to analyze the whole thing, as you say, and hopefully
take
a look.
Yeah, probably sometime in January we'll know what's in it, and we'll be able to really discuss it intelligently, because right now we're going by the seat of our pants.
Oh, actually, we'll get when our accountant tells us what we owe. That's what we're gonna pay. That's really
well. Mine's right across the room from me, so I can't say that.
Yeah, all righty. Okay. Well, have a good day, and thank you again for your show.
Thank you. You bet. Thanks. Appreciate your call.
Well,
we're going to go right to Carl's comments.
Well, there we go. Well, you know, this is the Christmas season, of course. And I know that everybody listens to various suggestions, and I'm going to make one today. Actually, one of the things we often do, in fact, most of us do it every year, and that is make New Year's resolutions. And so I thought, I have made some suggested New Year's resolutions for estate planning purposes. And I think that I'm going to repeat them, because I think you should sit down before you get into the Christmas spirit and before you get to, you know, January 1, because you're going to make up that new list. And I think you ought to just take this down and check off the ones that you actually did.
Uh-oh.
Then you can work through them. So the first one is read your last will and testament from, you know, 1972 or so. You know, the last one, you know, the one that's in the box under the bed, you know, under the rifle case, that one. You know, you should read that.
That's a great idea. Why don't on Christmas morning you read your will?
Write it off. Yeah, right. You know what? You could put, wrap it up in a present.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
And just let your kids know what their inheritance is going to be and say, Merry Christmas.
I think that's a wonderful idea. Here's another
one.
That
would be for a great Christmas dinner, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So there you go. So review your will and testament and or trust if you have one. And then the second thing you should do is locate your safe deposit key. Because it's hard to get in there without one. And then at the same time, you probably ought to make sure that whoever is supposed to get it when you die has access to that box, because it's a little challenging to get into it.
You're an expensive locksmith, aren't you?
Except my hourly would just kill him. It would be just horrible.
Yeah.
No. So the next one is to write down a list of assets you own and where they are. You know, include your collection of My Little Ponies and all that stuff, you know, good stuff. No, another one you need is to write down the list of all of your advisors, you know, your financial advisor, your CPA, your tax advisor, your lawyer, you know, and your mechanic, your IT company that, you know, manages all of your electronic devices. All of those people, who they are, where they are, telephone numbers, emails, that kind of stuff. Write that down somewhere. That way it's easier to find. You know, then you should probably put a list together that you have made in 8 and 7, the two previous things. You should put that list somewhere where people can find it. That's sometimes hard for people to do. They put it away in a place that they knew that it would be safe. Well, it not be totally safe, because then you can't find it. So just think about doing that. And then what I would do is tell three people that are trusted people where it is, so that they, at least somebody ought to know if something happens. You should review and confirm all of your joint bank accounts, beneficiary designations, transfer on death, pay on death things. And you should do that, I think, once a year just to make sure. Make sure that the company has it in writing and you have it in writing that those are the beneficiary designations that you've designated. And we have a caller on the line.
Yeah, we got a caller, Ray from Seattle. Ray, are you there?
Hello.
Hi, Ray. You got a question about the taxes and deductions?
Yes, I'm a senior, and my standard deduction is about $24,000, and then I get $8,000 personal exemption. But with these new rules, I won't get that $8,000 standard deduction because exemption because the standard deduction goes to $24,000. So, in fact, my income will go up by $8,000 taxable income.
Okay. Well, first off, I don't think your standard deduction currently is $24,000. I think the max is going to roughly be about.
No, I'm not talking about standard itemized deduction. My itemized deduction is $24,000.
Okay. So you're going to be probably about tax neutral. It sounds. $24,000 and $8,000 would give you $32,000, and then you'll still.
It's a senior. You said you were a senior, right?
Yes.
Are you single or married?
Married.
Okay.
Okay. So, let's see here. Recapping this, it sounds like your new standard would be 24. You'd still get your itemized to 24, but you're correct. You will lose the exemptions of $4,000 apiece, so $8,000 total. Hopefully, the revised tax brackets will make up for some of that also.
I tried the calculation of the rates. They're going like 10% and then 22%, and I still end up paying more tax.
Still end up some on there. And that's why when Chuck was talking earlier about never say never on everything. There's certain loopholes and certain circumstances.
Yeah, there's always going to be exceptions to every rule.
Yeah, and in this case, you're getting the benefit of. I would probably look at stacking your itemized deductions in 1 year and getting well over that $24,000, and then reverting to the standard deduction in another year, since you're right on the cusp of standard and itemized.
I don't think I can do that because it's property tax and mortgage interest.
Yeah, mortgage.
So there's no way I can get do double in 1 year and then not claim the next year.
I see. Yep. Well, that's. I think you're kind of looking at it accurately. It's that looks about right.
Yeah. The only thing you want to do realize is nothing's actually final yet. So. I still think there's probably some negotiation going on, and when we see the final numbers, then we'll really know.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. Thank you. Thanks for the call. That's a good call.
Very good analysis, yep.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got Lee from Portland on the new tax bill. Lee, are you there?
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I've called in a bunch of times, so I was hoping, Chuck, you would describe me like you did Henry, like a loyal listener, but I guess I'll have to get over my hurt feelings.
Oh, I'm sorry, Lee. I will put it down, and next time we'll have trumpets playing.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
All right, on this new tax bill, I've listened to your show a lot, and it's a great show. And you have said a number of times that if we get over 20 trillion in the national debt, we are in a world of hurt, and I don't know if we're quite there yet.
Oh, we went by it months ago.
Okay. So on top of that now, there's going to be a whole lot, I've heard of some pundits in the news saying that there's going to be a whole lot less tax money coming in from people for a while, and that's going to accelerate that debt, at least for a number of years. And as you probably know, or as I believe, I don't believe the government's going to cut back in their spending until some sort of apocalypse comes down the road. And so I'm wondering what you think will happen nationally in the interim. And I'll give a little personal example. I used to work in a couple of careers that I made a pretty fair amount of money, and I racked up a lot of debt. And I since changed to a job that I don't make much money at all. And there was an interim period there where I had to pay off that debt and really downsize my lifestyle a lot less than it used to be. And I don't think I don't think most people would do what I did. And I don't think our country is willing to do that unless, again, there's some sort of huge crisis. What's your thoughts on that? And I'll hang up and just listen to you on the radio. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, I can give my two bits on this because I think we're headed for a major correction in the market about 2019. I think we're going to get by 2018. I think the government at some point, the theory of what's going on, of what the conservatives are saying, is that if you lower taxes, people have more money. They'll put more money back into the country. Things will grow. We'll get GDP going up. We'll have the earnings of the country go up to 3 to 3.5 to 4%. And incidentally, we've had three quarters here of 3+, which has not happened in many, many years in America. And so that is the whole theory. My theory is if I were president for a day, I would go into the House and the Senate, and I would cut the government spending 10% across the board. Boom, everybody. It would be gone. And they would just have to do like all the rest of us have to do and live within the budget. The problem in the budgets in government, and I got to tell you, this happens in school districts. This happens in local government. This happens in counties. It happens in cities. Every one of them spend every damn dime in their budget so they don't get a reduction the next year. And we have gotten into the habit of the people running those departments, governmental agencies, and it's really bad in the federal government, just kind of shaking their head and saying, okay, well, we need an increase. Well, at some point in time, folks, we can't just keep spending money without any accountability. And I think there needs to be some total accountability. And I think department heads, some of these department heads are making $500,000 to $1 million a year in the federal government. I think if those guys are making that kind of money, I think they ought to be a little accountable for the money they're spending, particularly since it's our money, not their money. Now, granted, they pay taxes too, so it's part of their money too. But at some point, this government is going to have to be accountable and say, you know what, we got to cut spending. And I know everybody says, oh, you can't cut this, you can't cut that. I'm on Medicare now, and I could tell you, I had a nice talk with somebody when I had my hip replaced, and I talked about this on the air. I didn't talk about this part of it, but now that it came up, I will. I went to certain places to get, you know, walking places, things to help me, a cane and a walker and stuff, because I had to have them when I first got operated on. And one of the places I went, the price was way lower than everybody else through Medicare. And I said to this lady, I said, how come you're so much cheaper? And she says, Medicare is a license to rip people off. The government's paying the majority of the cost, and then we get to turn around and charge you what we want. And I said, are you kidding me? She said, hey, listen, I have complained and complained to Congress. She told me the local people in Vancouver she's complained to. And I just was kind of amazed because I had never heard it because I'd never encountered it before. But then I started looking at the stuff I'm buying that I buy with my Medicare and what Medicare is paying for it. And then I looked at my medical bill of what paid out and what I had to pay. Oh, my God. That, you know, for being in the hospital one night, $60,000-some? Are you kidding me? Well, yeah, I did get a new hip. Did get new, you know. But I'm telling you, there's got to be some control on costs. Costs are out of sight. But you still have one, Carl?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, listen, anyway, that's my two bits on that. I think government has so much waste in spending that we could totally, I could sit here and tell you, if I were president for a day, I'd take the Department of Education and be gone. I'd take the Indian Land Bureau Affairs, and listen, I'm about a 1/80th Cherokee, whatever that matters. It doesn't. But I'd be taking the Indian Land Bureau Affairs, and I'd be giving them their own country, and I'd be putting a wall around that damn thing and saying, you run your country, we'll run ours. You got the casinos. You do your own tax structure. Oh, and you pay for your own insurance because we're paying for it, guys. So I let them pay for it. You could cut a lot of money out of the federal budget by just getting rid of some departments, and that's what I would do. Yeah, I'd probably never get reelected, but you know what? It would sure as heck help the country. So, Kevin, that's my two bits. You got...
Nope, that's...
I thought you were going to give me some...
No.
Okay, that's okay. I like it. We're going to take a quick break and come right back with another caller. You're listening to Investing Simplified on the Investing Simplified Radio Network, and we'll be right back.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Colson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Colson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We are located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercolson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercolson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Colson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask Kevin Stege, CPA and shareholder of the Baker Colson CPA firm, that tax question that's been keeping you up at night. You can call Kevin 503-417-9595 or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's the CPA with the tax answers, well, Kevin Stege.
This is not a CPA, but I could play one and I could give you some answers that Kevin probably wouldn't like to have you say. But we're going to go right back to Carl Jepsen and talking about Carl's comments.
Well, I'm just going to finish up because I got a couple left to go. And we were talking about possible New Year's resolutions that you might make, and you should do that. So
Actually, Carl, we got Betty on the line, and she's got a question right for you.
Okay. Well, then I'll give her a resolution.
Yeah. Betty, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you. In my will, I have my one daughter as executrix, and I have three daughters, and the one I have in there is local. She lives in Portland, and so, like, if the house would need to be sold and all that, but... Another daughter would be the one I would want to do all. She would do all the bill paying and all the, you know, many, many things that are following death. Is there any way to have co-executors?
It is possible. One of the things that is problematic with that sometimes is just some practical problems. That means that the two of them have to be in the same place several times, or depending on, you know, having to sign things together. That can be a little bit challenging, especially if one lives out of the city or someplace else. The other thing is that if there's a disagreement, they both have equal authority. And now, obviously, it's pretty rare that this happens. I think we see it. We as lawyers see it more often than that because we see the ones that fall apart. But because most of them go through without much trouble. But what would happen there is that then if you did have a disagreement between the personal representatives, then you'd have to basically go to the court and they would make a decision as to which way to go and resolve the disagreement that way. So other than that, you can do it. If you don't have a will, at least I know that here in Multnomah County, the judge won't appoint co-personal representatives generally unless they post a bond. And you have a will, most wills say, and my personal representative can serve without bond. That's just an insurance policy that they have to purchase that says that if they steal the money, it's going to be paid back to the estate. Well, not that they're gonna, but that's just an added inconvenience. So I would recommend against the COs because just of convenience. There's nothing that says that the one daughter can't assist the other, though. You know, even if it's not signing stuff, they could you know, help them with chores and, you know, write out the checks or whatever they needed to do.
Oh, they could do it. They could write out the checks, Matt, because that's the thing. The girls agree that this is the way it would be best, because the one would be here to sell my house in Woodburn, and the other one could take care of all the.
Well, they could write them out. I think that if you were deceased and then they'd have to the personal representative would have to sign the checks. But you're, you know, like in my office, when we do probate type works, when we send out checks, my legal assistant, you know, writes out the check and I sign it. I mean, so you can do that kind of stuff. But like I said, I don't think appointing them through the court as a co-personal representative is always a good idea.
Could I have the one to be doing all the paperwork and all that just somehow sign the local one to sell the house and house and car or any property?
No, are you thinking about after you pass away or before?
Yes. After I pass away, could the one that's going to be doing all the paperwork and all that, I guess that would be the personal representative.
No, the personal representative would have to sign all of those papers. Yeah.
Okay, so if I change to that one, could she have the one that lives locally sell the house? Could she have somebody else do that?
Well, she would hire a realtor to show it, you know, and to advertise it and all of that stuff. And then, you know, the personal representative, though, would have to sign all of the agreements. Now, if you talked about just going there to let the person that has to go there and open the door so that they can go in, yeah, the non-appointed person could do that on behalf of the personal representative. But anything that is going to be a legally binding work is going to have to be signed off by the personal representative.
Okay, if I did the person representing, I would change it to my will, because right now I have the local one, but the other one's in California. But she's really good in all the bookwork and all that stuff. The one in Portland is so busy that she knows that she would be the one to come here and handle the sale of the house.
Mm-hmm.
But so it's kind of like. They've got completely different roles, and they agree that too. But I don't know how I could work that into my will.
Well, I think that your personal representative, whoever it is going to have the responsibility to make those things happen. And if they're going to want to work with, you know, I don't know that you can prescribe that in the will. I suppose you could just say that I hope that my two daughters work together on this, even though I'm naming daughter one as a personal representative. I think it's really good to have somebody who's really in charge, because, you know, if you have somebody who's, you know, essentially asked to take care of a bunch of stuff, but they really don't have the legal authority to do it, then and somebody else does, you know, I think that's going to ask for conflict and differences of opinion. And so I would just let her do it any way she needs to do it. She could get other people here to do stuff like that. If you're, you know, what happens is they get an estate bank account, and the personal representative pays the bills through the estate bank account. Personal representative hires the realtor. Personal representative hires the lawyer. Personal representative, you know, basically takes the money from the sale of the house and you know, puts it in the bank. And then when it's time, signs all the checks to distribute the money to whoever's supposed to get it. You know, there are some running around that needs to be done sometimes, but I think it's best to have just one person in charge of that.
Okay, thank you so very much.
You bet.
Great. Thanks for the call, Betty. We've got Evie on the line. Evie?
Hello.
Hi,
this is Evie, and thank you, Chuck, for your wonderful show. We listen to you every Saturday morning while we're drinking our coffee.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and having our Norwegian meal.
Well, it sounds good. Yeah.
Okay, I have a question. My husband and I have a position that we work together. We've been together. We fill a niche in life. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but We've been working together for many, many years. And this new position we have, we are going to be splitting our salary in two. And I'm going to be retiring myself. I'm 10 years older than him. And we're going to be retiring. I'm going to be retiring, not him, in about three years. And I'm wondering, should he, and they'll do this for us, should he get most of the salary and I just get a small amount for tax purposes, or should we just split it in half? And he may continue working for them after I retire in 2 years. I'm just thinking of Social Security.
Oh, very good question. That would probably, to do a good analysis on that, would take a review of your whole tax picture, each of your Social Security accounts, what you've paid in, and somebody could probably do that and come up with a good advice for you on
that. Yeah, in addition, your investment portfolio and when he planned on retiring, and we could pretty well calculate that out for you, but it'd take a lot more than just, you know, what we're saying
well,
here.
Well, we have about almost 700 saved, and then if we sell our home, we'll have over a million. So we are thinking of maybe selling it, possibly in 2 years, and getting a smaller home. But he wants to continue working.
Well, are you going to take Social Security when you retire?
Yes, I should. I'll be 68. So.
Oh, okay. Well.
Or 69. I'm not sure when I want to do it. I'm not in a hurry to get it. I don't need to get it right now.
Yeah. If you don't get it, it's growing at 8% a year, and that's a pretty good rate.
Yeah, I know all about that. I think it's great. I have friends that have taken it when they're 62, and they wish they hadn't.
Yeah, absolutely. So, that's the biggest thing I hear when people come in. They sit down, and they say, you know, I really wished I wouldn't have did that. But the thing is, it depends on the tax bracket you're going to be in. And do you guys have a retirement plan where you're at?
We do. We're with Vanguard. And
okay, like is it like a 401k or a 403b, something like that?
No, we don't have a 401k. We have just the Roth.
Nothing through our work.
Nothing through our work.
Oh, nothing through your work.
No, we just have the money we saved through the many, many years.
Okay, well then in actuality, Kevin, whether they both worked or one of them just worked, they could still, even if one of you is still working, you could still do a Roth every year for each of you. So since you don't have a retirement plan, I think it wouldn't really matter whether the income was him or you split it.
Yeah.
It wouldn't really make a difference because you're doing joint income.
Except for Social Security benefit, and that's
Social Security, yeah, because they charge you if you make over 40 grand, right, with Social Security taxes.
No, are you talking about when you're working?
If I retire and he's still working with our joint tax, what's it called?
Yeah, your Social Security your Social Security benefit that you collect would be taxable up to 85% based on.
Yes.
It sounds like the dollar amount you're talking, you would probably be subject to 85% of it would be taxable, but you know. Kind of to answer your question, the only benefit in this is probably looking at are you maxed out on your Social Security, or do you want your husband to have more working credits and dollar amounts on his side? And you know that's there's a lot that goes into that advice.
Yes, he does. He's worked since he was very young, and he has a lot more coming than I would in my Social Security.
I see.
Yeah, then I would say that if that's the case, then at your point, if you're going to retire, I would just put the income onto him. He could still do
that's
the he could still
thinking.
Do the
that's
he could still do
thought.
The Roth for both of you.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. They want to split it now 50-50 with our salary, and I was thinking if when I retire, just give him almost. Just give him all of it. They have to have me on something, though, if I'm still working for them.
Well, you're on Medicare because you're over 65.
Yes,
so
I love it.
So insurance isn't a thing, but insurance is probably a thing for him. Do you have medical for him?
That's a good question, Chuck. That's why we love you. he does have medical, and he's with Providence now, and it's $500 a month.
Listen, maybe you could call back next week. We only got 30 seconds, so we got to get off the air.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah, we'll if you want to call me at the office, I can answer some questions for you.
Okay, I will. Thanks.
Okay, thank Bye. You. Kevin, how can we get a hold of you?
503-666-5569, baker-colson.com.
Carl Jepson, carljepsonlaw.com, 971-229-0585.
And you can get hold of Chuck Price at pfgwm.com, 503-253-3000. And if you go on Amazon, I got a best-selling book called Your Retirement Made Simple.
You can listen to past shows of Investing Simplified or sign up for our free newsletter at www.pfgwm.com. This show was brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103, Portland, Oregon, 97216, 503-253-3000 or 877-50-PRICE. Investing Simplified is a registered trademark owned by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated. Are you concerned about your retirement income? Do you really understand how your Social Security benefits work? Price Financial Group Wealth Management has helped many seniors in Oregon and Washington maximize their Social Security benefits at retirement through using their Social Security seminar on demand. Now you can watch this valuable information in the comfort of your home by just going to www.pfgwm.com and click on the free Social Security kit. If you are serious about your retirement planning, you cannot afford to miss this opportunity. After all, you have invested your hard-earned dollars into Social Security all your working years. So shouldn't you get the maximum return you can get from those dollars? The future can be scary, and without a plan, it can be even scarier, especially when facing the unknown. What you don't know can hurt you. Get your free Social Security kit at pfgwm.com or call 503-253-3000.